Hi, Ken here. At unfetteredmind.org, you'll find transcripts of this podcast series, and these you can read or download free of charge. The transcripts are divided into small sections with audio clips. This makes it easy for you to listen to the specific passages that catch your interest. If services like these are useful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate. So he can maintain and expand the site. Thanks.
Unfettered Mind. 37 Practices of a Bodhisattva, Part 2.
All right, I will speak up. Is that better? And just remind me, please, because my voice does drop. Okay. Precious human birth. Eight favorable conditions and the 10 special conditions. Any questions? Any thoughts, reflections, anything you want to look at in connection with that? Jessica?
You had mentioned in your email that you might go over the importance of the order.
Of lists.
Particularly this one.
Particularly that one. Yeah. If I could, I said.
Yes.
Okay. The sequence in the eight freedoms I think and often when I'm looking at the order of these things, I have to sit down and think, you know, what, there's always the logic in the order. What is the logic? And to me, what suggests itself as the logic here is that you're moving from more obscured to less obscured states. Now, I'm going to go in a slightly different direction from Jessica's question here. The material that we're working with was formulated and presented in a traditional mythic society, which means that these realms were really felt to exist. This was their cosmology. This is not our cosmology. A colleague of mine made the observation that a culture's cosmology is a reflection of their of the culture's psychology. From the way that we approach things, it's very difficult, I think virtually impossible, for a person who's been brought up in a modern reason-based culture to adopt a mythic traditional culture and still function healthily. People almost always revert to things like magical thinking. Mm-hmm. The two can be incorporated. And that's essentially what I see us engaged in. So, one of the things that I'm hoped to be able to at least give you the flavor of, if not actually get you to learn, in working with this text, is how to read and understand and think critically about the text. And I don't mean the sense of critical analysis. I mean how to take this into, interpret these texts so that they become alive and meaningful to us in our society and our culture, not as most of us did originally, have to move back into Tibetan culture, which I did essentially for about 7 or 8 years. not an altogether healthy process, if I may say, process or a thing to do. So, if you look at these, what does hell being correspond to in our thinking?
Anger.
Now, how present are you when you are consumed by anger? Okay. And the hungry ghost?
Greed.
And so forth. Pardon? Greed and need, yeah. And so forth. So you go through this, looking at these, one way to look at this is in terms of our life now. Okay, how much of your life are you not angry, not consumed by greed, not preoccupied with survival, not intoxicated by desire or enjoyment, oblivious to the Dharma or spiritual practice, skeptical or harboring materialistic or realist ideas, have no sense of any spiritual presence in your life, and are impaired one way or another. So just in round figures, what proportion of your life are you in none of those states? Anybody? Maybe you should do a poll here. Okay? Yes?
What happened to the Titan realm?
No, it's not explicitly in here, no. You'll have to ask Nagarjuna. I don't know. Okay? I don't have an answer to that. I mean, I could say something like, well, it's subsumed in the Preta realm or it's subsumed in the God realm, because those are ways that it's subsumed when you take the six realms to five, but I don't know why they didn't put it in. So, when you think of this list this way, what happens in you? The way that I just suggested. Okay, anybody else? Not only it's about us, it's about us right now. Okay? Now, some of you who've worked with me on other texts know that I have this way of looking at things, but this is how you will make traditional texts come alive for you. And the question is, what does this mean to me in terms of my experience right now? Now, it's not always obvious. Some of the stuff is locked up in code over the centuries that it's actually quite difficult to penetrate. But I would like you to learn how to do that, because it's going to open up vast areas or vast bodies of texts in a very, very different way. And this could be very helpful to you. Okay. Any questions about that? Okay. The next one, the five that come through oneself. As a human in a country where the Dharma exists with one's senses and intelligence intact without karmic compulsions to commit evil deeds, is the person able to have faith in the three jewels? Well, this is simply a logical sequence. No Dharma or no Buddha. Oh, sorry, this is that one. The basis is being human. And then you add each of these things. So each one of those becomes a smaller and smaller subset. And it's the same with the next five. In an age when a Buddha has appeared, in an age when the Buddha has taught, in an age when the Dharma has not declined, and so forth, there's so many talks that I translated for Rinpoche when he would say, it's rare that a Buddha appears, even when a Buddha appears, it's rare that he teaches or she teaches. And even when they teach, it's rare that it lasts for anything more than the lifetime of that person. And that's just how we talk. And when you think about this, these are another set of conditions that build one on top of the other. So, and by going through that, well, yes, it has to be this, and there has to be this, and there has to be this, that again reinforces the feeling like, oh, this situation shouldn't be taken for granted. And that's the whole thrust of this section. Okay? Does that help?
Yeah.
Right. Any questions? No. In one sense, most of the verses that now follow are very much easier to understand. There aren't going to be that many technical explanations. I'll be very happy to answer to the best of my ability any questions you may have about translation choices, because I know you've been comparing various translations, and I think that's a really good thing, because if you don't compare translations, you're completely at the mercy of the translator. Yes, George.
To follow that, what was behind your choice of the term spiritual air?
Yeah, see, on my version I have bodhisattva, which is the, is it up on the web? Does it have spiritual air?
No, I think the version I had was from Sunday.
Oh, yeah, okay. Now, the reason... The name of the text is Jalse, in Tibetan, is Jalse Laklen. And it's worth talking about the title a little bit. Jalse Laklen Sumcha Sodun. Sumcha Sodun is just 37. Laklen means literally to take in hand. So that's often been translated as practice, but you take it in hand. Lak du lempa. Lak is the word for hand. Len is to take. So you take in hand. There may be others. It could also be translated as application. And then the term jalse is an epithet for bodhisattva. Jalse means the king's son. Or prince. In this case, the king is Buddha, so it is the Buddha's son. It's a masculine-oriented term, and so the trouble is: okay, how do you translate? And it's the idea that bodhisattvas are the offspring of Buddha. Okay, you have Buddhas. And what do Buddhas produce? They produce bodhisattvas, and then the bodhisattvas grow up into Buddhas, and they produce more bodhisattvas. It's a family metaphor, royal family metaphor, actually. So the question for me then was, okay, well, son is a totally gender-biased translation, and in today's age, nix. And so offspring doesn't sound right. I suppose you could translate it as scion, but that has another connotation. So I settled on air as the best that I could do, even though, strictly speaking, the feminine of air is heiress, but you can get away with it. But in the end, after struggling with that, then I just said, the hell with this, we're just going to shift it back to bodhisattva and make it simple. And that's typical problem that one faces as a translator. You have all of these terms which have different flavors, but sometimes just the way the languages are structured, it's very difficult to carry it across. Okay? Now, yes?
In that case, what's the difference in the meaning between geshe and geshe?
Oh, they're two different words. Gelse is son of a king. Okay? Geshe is that she is the word to know, and ge is the word for virtue. So one who knows virtue. And it's equivalent to a PhD in Buddhist theology or whatever. Okay? So they're totally different words, even though they sound... I mean, Tibetan's a terrible language because everything sounds the same to our ear, but they're actually very significant differences. you know, gyalse and geshe. Okay. Okay. Anything else? Okay. Verse 2. Or practice 2. Attraction to those close to you catches you in its currents. Aversion to those who oppose you burns inside. Indifference that ignores what needs to be done is a black hole. Leave your homeland. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. So, over the week, you're going to study and reflect and meditate on this. So, what were the results?
I have resistance within my homeland. I see that, and I think this is why I can never do this.
Okay. Anybody else? Julia? Okay. Can you expand on that? And speak up so we catch it.
Well, when I think of leaving England, you know, there's a whole set of things in England that you like and you don't like because you're English. Including Americans.
Except it's the French.
And then, but also on a personal level, I realized on a personal level that operated very strongly. So although I left my homeland, I still had a whole other series of things that I had likes and dislikes about here. So when I'm back in England, there's a whole set of things I can complain about. And when I'm here, there's a whole other set of things.
So the cultural and social conditioning of likes and dislikes. Okay, anybody else? Deborah.
When I was reading the commentaries about homeland, it occurred to me that perhaps homeland is not necessarily a physical place. It's not a metro or a county or a city or a house. It's more internal. That's where I was seeing it. It could be ignorance, it could be hurt, it could be my identity. It's somehow the way that I see things. I can abandon that ignorance, I can let go of it.
Okay, so different interpretations of homeland. Okay, Perry?
Well, I sort of think of myself as taking up residence in lots of different places all the time. I'm either, you know, making my home attraction, or making my home aversion, or spending lots of time
indifference, and those were,
you know, and so
if I leave all three behind,
then
that would be.
Okay. Steve?
I was curious why, if there's a significance to attraction to those close to you, as opposed to attraction. Like,
Okay, well, that's a translation point, so let me comment on that. Tibetan is full of redundancies, and we would tend to say, and it's good that you're bringing this up, because one gets absorbed in it, so used to it, you don't think about it, and then you miss that it isn't quite English. The idea is that you. You're with the you hang out with a group of people because you're attracted to them. So the ones you're attracted to are the ones that become close to you, and that's why it's attraction to those close to you. They're the ones that you draw around you. So family, friends, colleagues, so forth. And it would be better actually It might be better to translate the attraction to those who accord with you.
Yeah.
Because then it would get the better, the construction in the next sentence, aversion to those who oppose you. That might actually be a better translation. So.
One of the other versions is, attached to your loved ones, you are stirred up like water.
Yes. Pardon?
That sounds sort of the same.
There's a reason that I don't use attached, for even though a lot of people do, and you hear about attachment. You can be attached to things you don't like. You can be really attached to things you don't like. That's one piece. And that particular translation is at what I would say the surface level, or the surface level is too unkind. It would be the outer level. And it's basically what it literally means. You have these people you care about, and because you care about them, you get caught up in all of the stuff. You follow? It's as we're discussing this, I'm thinking it may be interesting to translate this so that it has a little more ambiguity to it, a little freer translation. Rather than attraction to those who close to you, you could say attraction to what accords with you. Because we get caught up internally as well. And that may not be actually out there. And Deborah raised this point in her comment about homeland. One of the things that some of you have probably seen in translation of Tibetan texts is levels of interpretation. And there are typically three or four levels of interpretation. There are probably additional ones, but these are the three or four main ones. In three, it's outer, inner, and secret, or mystery level. And if there's four, it's outer, inner, secret, and ultimate. Now, if we play with this one in that framework, the outer interpretation would be the people I love and care about, and I get caught up on all of that, and the people I really don't like to hang out with, and I get up, my own anger gets me all upset, you know how that is, and so forth. The inner level would be there are a number of ways you could take it, but it might be aspects of my experience that I like and I try to hold on to, and things in my experience I try to get rid of. So now, instead of being external objects, it's experience, which includes thoughts, feelings, sensations. And then at the secret level, because I'll just do a three on this one, it might be attraction itself, the very dynamic of attraction, the very dynamic of aversion, the very dynamic of indifference. So that's another way to be alert to interpreting these texts, is on those levels. So, and this, if you're alert to that, it will always bring you into a way of reading the text that means something to you personally, and it may mean a lot to you personally at different levels in your practice. Do you follow? Okay. You have a question, Anne?
Yeah, well, I just have a comment on homeland. Well, I decided it reminded me of the comfort zone.
Okay.
Your reactive patterns.
Yeah.
Just sort of getting out of your comfort zone.
Well, let me talk about homeland a little bit. Milarepa, one of Milarepa's more famous sayings is, if you want to get to work out your anger, you have to leave your homeland. And he meant it absolutely literally. Why?
Because of the charged memories and charged experiences, the conditions, your reactions.
And I think that's basically the case. That's where we grew up in. How difficult is it to undo all of that early conditioning? It's really hard. I mean, I've worked with some people who engage spiritual practice and keep bringing into me their really difficult family interactions. And after a while I say to them, you know, trying to work through this stuff when you're interacting with your family like this is basically like trying to windsurf in a hurricane. In theory, it's possible. But it's really, really difficult because the stuff is being re-triggered and reinforced all the time. So this is one of the reasons why retreat is really very, very important. Retreat serves many functions, but one of them is that it gets you out of that stuff. Now, absolutely, you carry it all with you, but the external circumstances aren't there to keep re-triggering it. You may have some plenty of internal circumstances which keep re-triggering it, but at least you got rid of one set of re-triggering things. So that's one of the reasons we do retreats. We get right out of the city environment, we get to another place, and everybody knows that, everybody who's come to one of these retreats knows this, because when you get right out of the city, there's a whole bunch of conditioning, just the way that Julia was talking about, which you're able to drop. Often it takes a day or two to drop it, but you know, the cell phone doesn't work, so you stop doing it, you know, and you can't access the internet, so you stop checking email and the phones. I remember organizing a retreat for Jangan Kontrol at Mount Baldy. And Kontrol is, unfortunately, was killed in a car accident. He's a really wonderful teacher. And normally he'd be traveling around and he'd be teaching, but every minute of his day was filled with phone calls from all over the world and people wanting interviews and things like that. So we set up this retreat over Thanksgiving weekend at Mount Baldy. We crammed 55 people into Mount Baldy. Every nook and cranny. And Kontrol said to me during the retreat, he said, "This is really nice. Nobody can reach me here. I like this. This is very restful." And he could focus solely on teaching, and it was a wonderful retreat. People who came to it said it was the best thing that he'd done in his whole North America tour, because people had actual interaction with him. He did interviews with everybody. Had one poor guy sitting out in the snow banging a gong at the end of 5 minutes. But that's why we go into a retreat, is to get out of the actual external circumstances. Theoretically, yeah, it's totally possible, but it's actually more difficult. So, and I know from my own experience that getting away, at least for some period, from that re-triggering of family stuff. Well, when you're in your family environment, there are a whole bunch of things that you just take for granted and you don't question. It's really, really hard to see until you get away. So there is an element, you know, of actually getting out of your homeland. There's another interesting point of this. Any of you heard the expression, a prophet is never recognized in his own country?
Mm-hmm.
A prophet is never recognized in his own country? Why? Yeah, that's just the kid next door. And it's actually quite exceptional, because all of that stuff is there. And out of this, I hope you can begin to appreciate just how heavy the conditioning can be. It really is. Now, there are other levels of interpretation, as Deborah pointed out. There's the internal homeland, which is the way that we're used to, somebody used the term comfort zone. Yeah, just how we're used to doing things, how we're used to approaching things. And as long as you want to stay in that, there is a limit to how much you will be able to understand and learn and experience spiritually. Why? How does spiritual practice regard a comfort zone? Pardon? Asleep. It's a place where you're asleep. So you're going to have to leave there. You're going to have to get out of bed. Sorry. And then, as Deborah pointed out, there are the deeper levels. There is this ignorance. And all of the habituation connected with that, which is actually a very difficult homeland to leave because it's so intertwined or embedded in us. And it's precisely because of this verse that when people express an interest in spiritual practice, I ask them, what are you prepared to pay? You've heard me ask that before, okay? It's another way of saying, how prepared are you to leave your homeland? And most people don't want to. In fact, most people won't. And that places an absolute limit on how far they can go in their experience of how things are. Why? Because how things are is not how we were brought up to consider them. I mean, what do we have in the Heart Sutra? Form and emptiness. Experience is empty. Well, that's not what you're taught in school. It's not what you're taught in your family. And so in order to come to those understandings, you have to leave those areas of conditioning behind. So this is very important.
Ken?
Yes?
All of those interpretations pretty much hit me, as well as this one. And it's concerning those internal attachments.
Yes.
And leaving my homeland, in a sense, implies an external action. You can correct me if I'm way off on this. But I took it, and I have an example of this. Well, I'll give the example because it explains it more clearly. I was completely identified with my business, totally attached to it. It's my baby. I started it 5 years ago. And I realized that, and I struggled with trying to separate, trying not to be so identified. And what finally allowed me some space, less identified, was actually planning to sell it to one of my employees, the escape plan.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as that was implemented, that I'm going to potentially be out in 3 years, the identification is diminished.
Yes.
And it seemed to require that external action of making the plan of externalizing the internal attachment and breaking it both ways, outer and inner at the same time. And I took this to one possible interpretation as being along those lines.
I think that's a very good point, Dave. The piece that I really want to focus on is you have to take action.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this doesn't happen by itself. So you may not have been aware of how deeply attached you were to your business. And then when you went, okay, suppose I sell this. Well, now it was an actual separation, and it brought you in touch with all of those internal attachments in a way that you couldn't have seen them before. And does it always need to be an explicit external action? Probably not. But there has to be something which brings all of that internal stuff into relief and requires making a gesture of separation. Now, that's actually what's at the heart of refuge. One of Trungpa's favorite interpretations of taking refuge is you become a refugee. What does a refugee do? A refugee leaves their homeland. Why? Because it's intolerable. And does a refugee know where they're going? No. So it's a very good metaphor. Steve?
One thing, another perspective of it, what I was thinking, is that every time I've left my homeland, for a couple months, things seem a lot better in the new land.
That's right.
And then I realize that it's the same.
Well, we bring it inside.
So then I took that and said, we're really talking more of the internal.
Well,
for me, that just
it really is helpful to do it externally. You have to do it internally, and that's what the real effort is there. Susan,
I was thinking of homeland kind of internally as well. Because I've been thinking about the sense of how I define myself and my experience.
Yep. That's right. Yeah. If I may pick up on that. Because one of the points I wanted to bring out in respect to this particular verse is a way of seeing the structure of our conditioning. There's base level ignorance, which you want to experience base level ignorance? It's very simple. What are you? Well, what happens? Yeah. And what do you experience?
Space.
Yeah. Actually, before the fear, you experience not knowing.
Mm-hmm.
That's base level ignorance. Okay? Now, that base level ignorance, because you cannot open to your own non-existence, because if you were open to that, you know what you are. Nothing. Know it and experience it, that would be fine. Because you can't open to that, a sense of other arises, and as soon as a sense of other arises, a sense of self forms in opposition to the other. That level of ignorance is called proliferating habituation. Nice, fancy technical term. It's where the dualistic mind develops. So you have base ignorance, and then you have this proliferating habituation ignorance, which is where dualism is formed. And as Susan was just saying, as soon as you have a sense of self, then you have the three poisons. Because now experience becomes interpreted in terms of what supports the sense of self, attraction, what threatens the sense of self, aversion, what is neutral to the sense of self, I don't care, indifference. You don't pay attention to that.
Well, maybe when you have a homeland is when these things happen.
No, that this is all the creating of the homeland, but the homeland reinforces this whole structure very, very powerfully. Above that, then you have the six emotional reactions. In other words, the six realms, which are anger and jealousy coming out of aversion, desire and greed coming out of attraction, and instinct and pride, or stupidity and pride, coming out of indifference. Okay? So that's the basic structure. Michelle?
Does living in homeland, whether it's literal or metaphorical, also mean that you lose a degree of attachment that you might otherwise have?
It creates the possibility for that to happen. It doesn't happen automatically.
I was thinking in literal sense because my dad is a Holocaust survivor, and by the time he was 16, he had lived on three continents and spoken five languages. And he's the most, you know, sort of easily adaptable person.
Yeah.
And so even though that's very literal, there's clearly something in that that enabled him not to attach.
Yes, but it also says something about your father, because there are a lot of other people who went through exactly the same experience and ended up very, very attached. You know, two people can have the same experience and learn two very, very different things. So that's why I say it creates the possibility. and that's really what we're trying to do in practice, is to create conditions or generate conditions which create possibilities, and then hopefully take advantage of the possibilities. Okay? So, have we flogged this one to death? Okay.
Can I ask you one more thing?
Well, I was going to ask you one thing, but you go ahead first, then I'll get you.
How many times can you leave your homeland? Because it seems to me that I've left mine once, then I create a new one, then you leave that one. I mean, at what stage?
Well, this is the Mark Twain theory of quitting cigarette smoking, isn't it?
Yes. It's always sweeter when it's the last cigarette.
No. It's ask me about quitting cigarette smoking. I'm an expert. I've done it at least 50 times.
Right. Okay.
Okay. You only have to leave it once.
Yeah.
Don't go back.
But you keep recreating it, don't
yeah.
you?
Stop doing that.
Mm-hmm. It's probably the same homeland every time.
Basically, yeah.
Okay,
now. So you've got a pretty good understanding of this. What was it like to really reflect on this or to meditate on this? What happened then? Julia?
I started to feel
sick. Okay. It was becoming real then. Yes, good. Okay, anybody else? Susan?
Started to see all the different areas when I'm still very much seeing.
Okay, good, good. Yeah, John?
I feel very frustrated because I don't know how to unload it all.
Let's come to that one, okay?
It all, to me, it all kind of came around and circled right into the difference why I realized.
It brought some clarity to you.
Yeah, no matter how I looked at it, if I went to different levels of looking at it, it always seemed that was the line and everything kind of, that was the lowest point where everything fell into place, but that was the most central. And at first, it didn't seem like this was important. And suddenly I realized, oh, yeah.
This is really important.
This is really important.
Yeah. So you found a well that you fall into, did you?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So you got clear about the nature of your homeland.
Yeah.
It's a black hole.
It's a black hole. Well,
you know the property of a black hole, don't you?
Well,
light can't get out. Light can't get out.
Right.
It's a long way from illuminating the world there, Peter.
Strangely, it wasn't that depressing.
Okay, Nava? Okay.
The
yep.
very hard things that they need to do.
Yeah.
And but also about question, just also realizing that it happens every moment. You know, every moment I have to leave my home. Every breath, I have to.
Yeah.
That.
Okay, good. Okay.
The image that came to my mind was like a turtle trying to leave its shell.
A little difficult.
Yeah.
Okay. How do you leave your homeland?
Kicking and screaming.
Okay.
Naked.
Yes. Now you remind me of, I may have told you this before, one night we were in, I was translating for Rinpoche, we were being hosted by a nice middle class family in a good part of Vancouver. And there's a typical Vancouver winter day. It was raining, it was cold, there was not a lot of thunder, but there's just this nasty, cold, windy rain. And we were inside, and there was a nice fire, and we'd had a nice dinner, and after that we were in the living room, and the husband and the family said to Rinpoche, "So, tell me what Buddhism is about." And Rinpoche said, he didn't do this kind of thing very often, but every now and then he did. He said, "Right now we've just had a really nice meal, and we're sitting around here warm. Imagine what it would be like to have to take off all your clothes and walk out into that stormy rain and all that cold, knowing you could never come back. Death's much worse than that." That's
what was the reaction to that?
I was like, "Thank you." Katagiri Roshi did the same thing, more or less. He had in Minnesota, they had this big fundraising thing, and so they had all of the elite of the city, and champagne and flowers, and everybody was dressed beautifully, and they had this nice thing, and the way they have the fundraisers, everybody gathers around, and then the star, whoever you're fundraising for, comes down and makes the little short little address, then goes away, and then you put the squeeze on for the money, right? Standard formula. So anyway, so everything was beautiful, and so time for Katagiri Roshi to make his entrance. And he comes down the stairs and stands in the middle of the stairs, addressing everybody, and says, "You know that you're all going to die, don't you?" It was not a very successful fundraiser. Okay, yes. It's not the reading I put on Genesis, if you're interested. The reading I put on Genesis is that it's the arising of ordinary consciousness from pristine awareness. Mm-hmm. And that once that's happened, you cannot go back. Mm-hmm. You've got to undo all of the habituation. Mm-hmm. And the arising of ordinary consciousness arises when you focus on one thing instead of open to everything. So that's what happened. Now there are probably other layers in there too, but that's my reading of Genesis. I see it's a little different from this. Okay. We've got to rush through the next two. Is this discussion helpful? Okay. Don't engage disturbances and reactive emotions gradually fade away. Don't engage distractions and spiritual practice naturally grows. Keep awareness clear and vivid, and confidence in the way arises. Rely on silence. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. That's what I thought it was. Okay, now, we're probably going to have a similarly involved discussion here. A little translation point. Strictly speaking, the English is not what it should be. The Tibetan reads, if you don't engage disturbances, reactive emotions gradually fade away. But to me, that particular construction in English doesn't carry any power. If this, then that. So I wanted to translate it into something which had more power to it. So that's why I put it into this incorrect English, where I have two principal clauses in the same sentence. But I hope you'll excuse me. Don't engage disturbances and reactive emotions gradually fade away. What's your take? Okay, anybody else?
Watch them arise and watch them fall away without engaging in the story.
Okay.
So, as internal crutches, Jeff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Engaging with them gives them more energy.
Mm-hmm. Julia?
So you brought two things.
Because it'll find you.
And the other one is that the line from the Guru prayer, give me energy to let confusion subside on its own.
Okay.
That kind of getting stuck to it.
Right. Okay. These are all right. Several of you are interpreting this at quite a deep level. Now, let's start at the first level, which is along the lines where Art was. And this is really basic Theravadan stuff, but it's just true. In the Theravadan tradition, one of the ways it's thought is that you become aware of negative mind states. And you just make a point of tracking negative mind states. Don't try to change them. You just take a point of tracking, being aware. When am I in a negative mind state? Now, this is a very interesting little thing to do. When you are aware of being in a negative mind state, when you are aware of a negative mind state, are you in a negative mind state? No. You've started to step out of it. Now you're just aware of it. And so, in this approach in the Theravadan, the idea is you start reducing the number, the amount of time you spend in negative mind states. And that by itself creates a condition for other states, other more constructive states to arise. Now, someone asked me once, why at the 37... practices. I don't know how he arrived at 37, except that the only time 37 crops up in Buddhism is the 37 factors of enlightenment, which I can't remember them all, but I remember the first eight. First four are the four foundations of mindfulness. And the second four are called the four right efforts. There are other names for them. Now, the four right efforts are very simple. The first one is reduce those things which are making things worse. The second one is stop those things which are making things worse. The third one is start doing things which make things better. And the fourth one is reinforce those things which make things better. Now, when you see it in the traditional thing, you know, it's worded a little more obscurely or a little more, you know, Victorian English usually in translation. But when you think of that, it just makes such wonderful common sense. Like, why wouldn't anybody do that? Do we? No. We continue to do things which make things worse, and lo and behold, things get worse.
What was that again, the 37 factors?
37 factors of enlightenment. I mean, you can type it into Google, and sometimes it'll be 37 branches of enlightenment, or so just put enlightenment in 37.
Actually,
And this is a list that runs through all traditions of Buddhism. So it's a very good list to know intimately. Of course, I don't know it. But the in the Vajrayana level, you know, the you don't know, but in the Vajrayana level, when you're doing the really elaborate visualizations, you visualize this palace in which the deity resides. Well, the palace is made up of stuff which each part of which symbolizes the 37 factors of enlightenment. So it's basically the house of enlightenment. You know, so you have these beams symbolize that, and these features of the house symbolize that. Every architectural feature it represents one of the 37 factors. So then the next one is don't engage distractions, and spiritual practice naturally grows. That's very similar. So this is like reduce those things which are making things worse. That's the first line. And the second one is, well, stop doing those things which make things worse. The third one, keep awareness clear and vivid, and confidence in the way arises. What was your experience there? A couple of people haven't spoken up. Joe, yes.
It seems a lot harder to hold on to than do the negative constructions of the first two lines.
Why is that? Why is it harder to hold on to? I think that's right. Keep awareness clear and vivid. Okay. Trick question. What's there to hold on to there? Anybody?
Nothing.
It's really hard. You know, what does the Tibetan say here? Yeah. I don't know what level Gyaltse Tome was conveying, but this is actually can be interpreted as an extraordinarily deep instruction. I mean, Mahamudra and Dzogchen. Keep awareness clear and vivid, and confidence in the way arises. That's the whole Vajrayana path, right there. If you want. That's all you have to do. Just keep your awareness clear and vivid. That's it. You can go home now. Mm-hmm. Molly.
How do you know, before you even get to the awareness part, how do you even know when you're distracted? With my thing that came to my mind was, I was thinking about the negative things that were making me worse, and I guess my answer to my question, I think, is that you can just be as aware as possible.
Okay. Can you be aware of being distracted? How many say yes? We'll have a vote here. How many say yes, you can be aware of being distracted? Pay very careful attention to my English. Can you be aware of being distracted? Can you be aware of having been distracted?
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Ah. Okay. When we're distracted, when we're in the distraction, there is no awareness. And we all know this in our meditation. There we are, happily meditating. Maybe we're sitting in clear awareness. And now I'm down at the Santa Monica Pier.
How did I get here?
Exactly. I mean, Jamkin Cantrell the Great writes in his biography. I was sitting in ritual one day, and suddenly I had this experience of a past life. And, you know, and just all the detail and everything like that. And then I came back to the temple and I realized I'd just been distracted. So
sometimes you can see a little thought come up and you don't have to attach to it.
That's right. Yeah, but that's all you get.
Yeah.
And if you don't do it then...
Yeah, it's all over.
Yeah. You remember the story about the monk and the clothes factory in my book? Well, the teacher and the monk, the monk and his teacher are coming along, and the teacher says, you know, this would be a really good place for you to practice. You know, so you just practice here, I'll come back and see how you're doing. So the monk sits down. And it's a perfect place. It's a little bit outside the town, so I can go and beg for alms and things like that. It's just right, according to all the conditions. Teacher comes back 2 years later. But things look a little different. He's not quite sure where the village... There's a whole town there. And there's trucks rumbling back and forth, and there weren't any trucks before. Yeah. And he goes to where he thinks the tree was, but there's now huge buildings and warehouses, and there's this great big glass tower. And he goes, what happened here? And eventually he finds somebody, because everybody's rushing around with their cell phones and BlackBerries and things. I'm looking for so-and-so. Oh, says the person, he's in that building. So he walks in the building, and there's the concierge. He goes up to the concierge and says, I'm looking for so-and-so. You have an appointment? No. I'm his teacher. Oh, well, I'm sure he'll make time for you. He calls up and says, go into the elevator, get off on the 10th floor. Gets off on the 10th floor. There's this magnificent office. And in this office, you know, there's this beautiful view and everything. Comes in. And there's his student sitting impeccably dressed in this wonderful business suit. A couple of aides with him, and he's giving dictation and et cetera. And look, the teacher looks at this and lightly clears his throat. The student looks up and says, oh dear, it all started when I thought I needed a new bulb.
A new what?
Robe. So all you get is that thought, and after that you're gone. Okay? So, keep awareness clear and vivid. Now, this next line, confidence in the way it arises. I may take some time next week. We'll obviously have to move a little. I was wondering what I was going to talk about this evening, but there seems to be plenty here. There are three kinds of faith. There's faith which is based on rational understanding. There's faith which comes out of a sense of longing.
A sense of what?
Longing. Longing for understanding, for presence, what have you. It's the faith which comes out of that. And then there's faith which is just like a kind of open clarity. Now, the ability to keep awareness clear and vivid and confidence in the way are intimately connected. The more confidence you have in the way, the more you can rest in open, clear awareness, holding on to nothing. And, just as it says here, the more you rest holding on to nothing, the more you see and understand the way things are, and that gives you confidence in the way. So this is a very, very intimate relationship. Now, the last line there, rely on silence. The word in Tibetan literally means isolation. It means getting away. This is not just leaving your homeland. This is being isolated. And it's discussed in terms of different levels of isolation, isolation from external busyness, isolation from internal distractions, isolation from the very activities of mind itself. I don't like to use the term isolation because it has this idea of, you know, fencing off or, you know, getting away from. And so I elected to translate it as silence, which I think more accurately conveys the meaning and the feeling of it. And maybe you'll recall something that I've mentioned to many of you in the past. Where does the silence go when noise begins? Yeah, it's still there. What we tend to do is we stop listening to the silence and our attention goes to the noise. Mm-hmm. We collapse down onto the noise. In your practice and in your life, if you can be connecting with the silence in everything you do, that's going to give a tremendous continuity to your practice. You can do this by observing space. That's silence at the physical level. Whenever there's noise, make a point of listening to silence. I can hear it while there is noise. And that's going to change your relationship to whatever noise there is. When there are thoughts, well, wherever there are thoughts, there's also non-thought. That's the silence. Can you be aware of that while there are thoughts? If you can do that, you'll never go to sleep. You'll never be distracted. So there's a lot of depth here in terms of instruction. Deborah?
Isn't that like blue sky?
Yeah. Yeah, opening to the sky is a way of doing that. And that's one of the reasons you do that, is because you get so used to that huge sky. It's deeply habituated in you from doing that practice all the time that you begin to relate to everything with that sense, and it makes a very big difference. Yeah. Okay. Okay, we'll stop here. Questions? Number four. So I'll do 4, 5, and 6. 7. 4, 5, 6, and 7 for next week. That's right. Yeah, that'll be fine. I think. And as we did this time, I mean, clearly you're thinking about it and working with it at various levels. It's very good. And I'd like to encourage you to keep doing that, because in doing so, you're learning how to read and understand this text in a way that becomes alive for you. And then when you turn to other texts, you're going to find that same quality. It also helps you tremendously in being able to detect what's bullshit. Because people's writings don't resonate at various levels simultaneously. Tells you immediately their level of experience, the writer's level of experience.
Unfettered Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you wish to use part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.